Well, I think it's 4 o'clock. I think we'll say welcome to the Pale Rider Surprise, as I've called it. I'll maybe explain that title in a moment. My name is Fred Niedner from Valparaiso, Indiana, and I'm teaching Theology of the Cross this week, and we watched a film last night, which brings up some topics related to this theme. The title comes from a previous Clint Eastwood movie. Pale Rider is a, I don't remember the date of that film, but it's not exactly one of the spaghetti westerns. In that film, in Pale Rider, Clint Eastwood was a minister, a plains or a frontier days Christian minister who apparently had a history, kind of a mysterious history, of an earlier life in some kind of violence or another, and he's changed and he's become a peaceful man and a minister, but he gets finally into a situation where he has to do the usual Clint Eastwood thing in order to settle things. You think that's what's coming this time, someone will finally have to do the typical Clint Eastwood thing in order to bring the right kind of ending to a difficult situation. That's the reason for the title. I wasn't going to see this film. I had a little bit of an eye opener session on it last week, the 7:15 in the morning things, and I explained that I had seen the trailers for this while watching some other film just prior to Gran Torino's appearance, and it looked to me like a typical Clint Eastwood film, which would end in the usual way, sort of a urban version of a spaghetti western. But I was out in Arizona with my colleague Mark Swain in January, and we had an evening with nothing planned. The event we had gone out to speak at was over, and there was a movie complex next door to where we were staying, and that was the only film even remotely interesting. And so we went to see this film. And if you'll pardon the expression, we were blown away.
Typical of these ones.
Yeah, and so I went home and told my wife what a remarkable film this was, and she actually agreed to go see it. She almost never will see a film that has violence in it, but even she is able to appreciate this one. And then, about 2 weeks after that, I was out in Detroit, where this was filmed, at a Book of Faith. I led a Book of Faith initiative weekend retreat on the Gospel of Mark for a congregation, and there was a woman there who you saw last night if you were here, in the funeral scene, the opening funeral scene at the church. Mm-hmm. There was a woman at this retreat who was an extra in the film, and she was there in that church scene, and she told me what a great time it was to be a part of this. She had so thoroughly enjoyed Clint Eastwood. He was such a pleasant person, so polite, friendly, and just sort of an ordinary guy to all these extras. She said that they sat through the filming in that house across the street, the one that Tao has to fix. That's where they spent most of their time, waiting for their turn to be on to go do things. And she said, of course, most of the time she spent with all those Hmong people, and only the young ones could speak English. but that they were all just very enjoyable to be with. Anyway, that was how I really got interested in this film, and the more I thought about doing theology of the cross sessions, the more I thought, well, we should show this and have a chance to talk about theology of the cross invading Hollywood. There was one line in the film last night that appeared to me to have gotten lost. I think someone coughed or something happened, but I really thought there would be a rise out of this group when they're riding in the pickup after the rescue of Sue from the three African-American gangbangers, and he asks, now, how did you even get here in the first place? And she said, well, the Lutherans brought us.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, everyone blames the Lutherans. Well, I mean, no one laughed last night, so
I didn't hear it.
We were laughing when she said Lutherans. I think we missed his part.
Yeah, we missed his part.
All right, so in case you missed it, that's what happened. So even the Lutherans got into the film. Well, I propose that before people begin to say, what do you think this means, that just for fun, we read this film as though it's a text and ask, what clues are there in this film that it's a little deeper than just a piece of entertainment? You know, what kinds of things did you pick up that clued you that there was something going on maybe a little deeper than your garden variety show about a bigot in his environment?
Well, I thought when the woman dropped her groceries and the three kids went up, did pass her by, and he said, that's how kids are today, and he was about ready to go, and the other young man came, and I thought that was rather significant in that you can't put everybody in a box and say they're all going to react the same way. There are a few people who will step out.
Yeah. Well, he was looking for people to affirm his values,
right,
and what he thinks young people should be doing, and so there was at least one.
Fred, I was personally just gratified that somehow that parish priest, who I thought was going to be a throwaway character, hung in, and had a deep commitment to the community, and I think really finally connected.
Yeah.
I miss Bing Crosby and the Bells of St. Mary.
Well, I think that similarity between the confessional booth and that screen where Clint had locked Mung behind that door.
Yeah.
I felt like that was...
Yeah, that was...
pulled to my attention that there was a lot going on here.
Yeah.
A lot more going on here than I...
Yeah, that's an unmistakable similarity, that the priest behind the screen and Tao behind the screen look almost identical. I mean, it's not an absolutely identical type of screen, but he's talking to two people behind the screen within a few moments of each other, and he's making a confession both times. And remember how the movie starts? Your wife on her deathbed wants you to make confession.
Right.
And so the whole movie is bracketed by confession.
I also thought that one of the earliest clues that this movie was going to be different is that most movies don't come at you so blatantly with issues of death and life and what they mean. And you have the priest with his early sermon, which, you know, was as ridiculous as Clint Eastwood thought it was. But then Clint Eastwood's speech, which was maybe also as one-sided or lopsided as the priest's. Mm-hmm. And so you have these two early, you know, forays into a topic that most movies don't come close to, or if they do, it's only obliquely, because that's not entertainment, and most people don't want to be entertained with death and life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's odd enough to start a movie in church.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that sermon is vacuous. Eastwood was right, and the priest admits at the end that it was. But the issues, yeah, life and death, that's what it was about. But confession really, really plays a big role in this film. I mean, you always know when you're reading any piece of literature or any other kind of art, if you have a bracketing device, it's a big clue that, at least in one way, this film is about confession. And everybody thinks they know what's the matter with Walt. And even the shaman diagnoses him, remember? You are worried about a big mistake that you made, and you have no peace. And the priest keeps bugging him, are you sure you don't want to make confession? It's a running theme. I think there's all kinds of levels, however, at which we can understand what's getting confessed and what the meaning of it is.
As a visual person, I was noticing that the gritty lighting and the non-prettiness of the visual images. I mean, last week we saw A River Runs Through It, and it was lush and bright and pretty lighting, and that this almost felt like a documentary more so than a Hollywood film. And that clued me in that I was in for a different kind of ride than a Hollywood blockbuster-y kind of thing, that the streets were that kind of overbright of late summer, and the wrinkles on Clint's face were not puffed away or like lit away.
Yeah. The film was criticized, I mean, I don't know, this is slightly off subject, the film was criticized for having bad acting. Yeah. If you go out on the web and you investigate critics and so forth, there's all sorts of comment that the characters, that, for example, all those young people were just a bunch of bad actors.
This was the second time I had seen it, and I kind of had, and maybe it was because of the reviews that I sort of had that reaction. First, the second time I saw it, I found the acting better.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I was sort of more involved this time, so maybe that was pretty.
Mm-hmm. Well, the actors were caricatures, you know, and cartoon characters almost, you know, especially Clint Eastwood when he was laying out his personality. So it was sort of the value of, it was almost a parable, and so you had these sort of caricature people and almost unreal kind of people, but that added to the value of the message.
Well, there's a pastor in the village whose parish is in that neighborhood, who works in the very neighborhood where the film was made, and she says that's everyday life in that neighborhood, and that Clint Eastwood and his character is, you know, a retired auto worker straight out of Central Casting. So maybe if that's a cartoon caricature, it's prototypical people of that culture. I mean, the gangbangers were cartoonish gangbangers, and he was a cartoonish bigot.
Luther said, God is mealing, malen langsam, aber sie malen ganz vortrefflich fine. God's mills grind very slowly, but they grind very, very fine. And that's what God was doing with Clint, moving him to the cross.
So you saw it as a picture of God grinding down Clint Eastwood, okay. Most of you agree with that?
I think so.
I like the idea there that, just God can connect with, you know, many people in different ways, and for some people it may take right up to the very end, you know, their 80s, 90s, you know, their latter years of life before, yeah. You know, some sort of connections made. That's interesting to me.
I was struck by something that was read yesterday morning, I believe, at Matins when the woman, I don't remember who it was, went through and was reading from the book that the woman had written and had the four comments that she read. One of them, the last one, was that God forgives the motive and accepts the deed. And I couldn't help but think that, you know, his motivation might have been any number of things, all of which were hinted at. I mean, suicide because he was going to die. I mean, you know, you could read a lot of different things into that. But the deed was one of salvation.
But the contrast between Clint Eastwood going and beating up that mountain foot and then realizing that what violence begets violence. I thought that was a beautiful contrast.
And I don't know if you want to get into a theology of the cross, how I saw it there, that Chuck and I believe, and that is, he obviously had some disease that was going to be terminal, and that's not the cross that we bear or things that happen to us, but when he chose to save the Hmong's life by going over to the gang and being killed, that's where theology of the cross is to us. You choose to do that. It's not the things that come bad, you lose your house or whatever, that's not your cross to bear, but it's something to bear, certainly. But the theology is that you choose to do whatever that is very difficult or almost impossible. I don't know if that's what you believe.
No, I mean, I'll comment on that briefly. I teach New Testament Gospels. I've taught the Gospels about, I don't know how many times, and I have this curious view of a certain story in the Gospel of John that to me fits perfectly here. Jesus raises Lazarus. Lazarus dies, and that story, there's a lot of layers to that story, but one of the weird things about this story is that Jesus raises Lazarus only to go off and not only die himself right afterwards, but put Lazarus in danger of being killed. Because mm-hmm. they start plotting against Lazarus right away too. And so Lazarus isn't going to last very long in his new life. He's going to get killed again. Because they're going to go up to Jerusalem and do whatever this thing is that Jesus is going to do. So it's almost like Jesus goes to Lazarus's grave and says, Lazarus, get out of there. You know, there's no point in dying a stupid death from some disease. Let's go up to Jerusalem and do it right. You know, there's dying, there's ordinary dying, and then there's dying. Lazarus, let's go die. You know, so he could have just died of whatever was making him cough up blood, or he could do something with his life. He could make, you know, he could find his life by losing it. You know, that's what that reminds me of. And he saved, if you think about it, he not only saved Tao, he saved those gangbangers. He says very near the end when he and Tao are, did he say this to the priest? He says, they don't have a chance. I've got this all planned out. They don't have a chance. Well, the way the movie ends, they're going to be in trouble. They're going to go to prison or something. But they have their lives and they will get another chance to grow up and be adult human beings. So he saves not just Tao, he saves the guys who kill him. Because now there could be something different. There won't necessarily be, but he saves more than Tao.
I think there's something too, though, to the similarities between what happens in this movie and what happens in Graham Greene's novel, The Power and the Glory, where there the whiskey priest, you know, has a way out for himself, but chooses to go back and pretty much go back to die. And the same thing is true of Clint Eastwood, but it's not a choice, really, in Graham Greene's novel, and I don't know that it was a choice, really, here either, that in some sense Clint Eastwood said this was the only way. You know, that this was the only way to save them. You know, so I'm not sure that I agree that there was as much choice here as it appeared to be. Yes, there was a choice between, you know, gunning them down or going to die. Yes, there's a choice between dying of your disease or dying this way. But in some sense, I think that Clint Eastwood had narrowed things down and realized that there was no other option. This was the only option. And when there's only one option, there's no longer choice.
The only option for what? No.
For resolution, for long-term peace, for Tao and his sister and family and for the neighborhood and so forth, that he had this planned out and worked out in such a way that all other options led to failure. And this was the option that led to the outcome that he was looking for. That, you know, and it reminds me of how in the Gospels, especially in Luke's Gospel, but probably in Mark's Gospel as well, you know, Jesus' language, the Son of Man must, you know, this isn't a choice language. This is compelled language.
I think one thing that supports that is that he tried, you know, the business of going and beating up that, intimidating the one gang member, and the result of that,
yeah,
was horrible, with the gunning down of the house and then the attack on both of them, you know.
Yeah.
So in some ways it kind of supports it, because he had tried maybe what he most traditionally would have thought of doing, and it was much worse.
Let me ask all of you a question. How did you feel when he first did that, when he beat up the one gangbanger on the lawn? Or, even more importantly, when he saved Sue from the other three guys from a different gang, and leaves them feeling totally humiliated by what he did? Did you like that?
Yeah.
But it was only a temporary fix.
Yeah, but you.
But you, yeah, know, we were almost here.
Don't you feel kind of exultant?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Totally.
But it seems like it's from another time. You know, that just showed how far back in the past he was living to think he could intimidate them out of it.
Yeah. But there is something in us, isn't there? Even us truly enlightened people up here on the mountain in the Golden Village. Who renounce violence and live for peace and all that stuff, when that kind of a moment happens, something in you says yes. You know, just think how many of even our favorite movies or stories of any kind end up with a resolution where finally somebody getting whacked in the jaw, or some bad guy getting shot, or something like that, finally brings resolution and we have peace. I mean, I started thinking about this when I realized the curiosity of how much I liked Back to the Future a generation ago. Remember that film? Where he goes back in time, and remember the moment that finally resolves the problem so that the future can turn out the way it's supposed to?
Yeah.
He whacks Biff in the jaw and knocks the bully out, or knocks the bully down, and then history changes. So that's just kind of what we believe. that if we finally just hit the right bully with the right blow, and have just, you know, an unfortunate but necessary moment of violence with which we fix things, now the world will be set right, and the movie can end, and everything will be okay.
Waking Ned Divine when the phone booth goes off the edge of the cliff.
I'm sorry, what?
In Waking Ned Divine, when the phone booth goes off the edge of the cliff and everybody gets to keep their lottery winnings?
No, I didn't see that, so I don't know.
The other thing that I thought was amazing was the girl, the sister, and her, her non-response, or not getting actually by all his language, and I was just amazed at her just kind of going about and not having any response to his name-calling, slanders, slurs, nothing. And then the family's whole response when he did help them with all the gifts. And I was kind of, I just was impressed. I thought she was an amazing character, that she just never responded to that. She seemed to see him for who he was, rather than all that outer stuff that tends to put us off.
Right.
She was almost playing with
him. Yes,
you know, just like accepting him there and just bantering almost in that way.
Right. A sweet way.
I mean, that whole, I guess the scene was with the beer and the dragon lady. And
yes.
I don't know what, she had some influence in there that she was playing with.
The whole bigotry aspect of the movie was, it wasn't very black and white for me. There were parts of that movie where it was like, it was okay he was a bigot because he was joking with his friends, but then when it came to the neighbors, you felt it was more serious and more offensive. And I think that character, what that was kind of showing me is that he's kind of silly. I mean, it's kind of irrelevant in a way, the way that he went on, and it wasn't who he was, and I found that interesting. I mean, the contrast between him bantering with the barber and then the way he talked about the neighbors, where he seemed to really mean it, and I think her age plays a role there too, because I think younger generations see that kind of stuff, and that's kind of the reaction. Oh, it's, you know, that's the way they are because they're old or because they're, you know, jaded or whatever. I just didn't see a clear line with the bigotry.
How did the rest of you understand the laughter in this room last night? For the first half hour, nobody laughed when he said these outrageous things. But gradually, people began to laugh at this, and of course, we were just roaring.
Because you start liking him.
Well, I think the way Sue responded by not taking offense, and the way the barber responded in some ways by not taking offense by it, almost made it okay to laugh.
Yeah.
It's because there was an offense taken that you could laugh at it rather than see it as offensive as it really was.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was what gave permission to laugh or not.
Well, I think that almost, it was almost hyperbole. I mean, was there a single racial epithet or stereotype that was missed in that whole movie?
No, I think
you know. I mean, you almost thought he must have had people doing research to come up with everything that could be said. But that, along with some of the other plain aspects of the movie, you know, we talked about whether the actors were good or not good, or, I mean, it was kind of a low budget kind of a thing. But I think all those things kind of washed away details or adiaphora, you know, things that weren't important, so that it became clear that this was about something beyond all those surface things. You know, and that's what part of it meant for me, was that there was something more going on here than all those, that was not important. Those things were details, but what was important was it was a real life, death, ultimate.
One of the things that I realized was how the bigotry functioned for him personally as the movie, you know, went on. You know, originally it made him this kind of vile person, and we didn't laugh. But then when you realize what he was doing was using it to keep everyone at arm's length, the priest, his family, the neighbors, you know, everyone. He was using it to keep them there so he didn't have to commit himself. He didn't have to involve himself. And when Sue comes and forces him to involve himself, and he still comes back with the stuff, and you see he's trying to keep people at arm's length, and then he lets them in. You know, and he likes the cooking and the attention, and he accepts the meals, and then you realize that you know what's happening here is that he's still trying to keep people, but he can't do it anymore, and it's not working. And when it doesn't work anymore, to do what he's trying to do with it, then it becomes comical. You know, before then it wasn't, but as it stopped working to do what he was trying to do, then it became comical, and you realize that especially you know, toward the end of the movie where he sits in the chair after he smashed his cabinets in anger over what happened next door, and the tears start to stream down his face, you know, you realize suddenly that there is a person in there after all, you know, and that's what's happened, you know, in the course of the film. You know, so the juxtaposition of trying to keep people at arm's length and it's not working, that was funny. No, at first it wasn't.
That whole get off my lawn.
Right.
Protecting his space, and then him taking his dog over at the end was just, I mean, that was profound.
So the difference is in us, not in him. Mm-hmm. He stays a bigot to the end. I mean, even his will. all this stuff about what he shouldn't do to the car, you know, like the zipperheads do, and all that kind of stuff. So, but it becomes okay with us that he's like that, because it doesn't work for the purpose he intended it, and it becomes foolish.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you mentioned it yesterday. I mean, this is kind of a movie about Clint and his own, you know, his own sort of trajectory through his own life. I mean, you know, if you sort of put this in the context of what he'd already done with the Iwo Jima, the seven films on Iwo Jima, I mean, this is a very different guy. And so part of what happened with me, at least, is I was watching him do a caricature of himself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, that early stuff when he would be grinding his teeth and his jaw bones would be working. And all, I mean, I just thought this was like back to Dirty Harry and the spaghetti westerns. And that was that old guy back there. And so you sort of watched, there's two layers of the transition. One was the character we saw on screen, but the other was sort of, I mean, it was sort of a different twist on his own path and the own the archetypical characters he developed earlier on. And so at some point, it all became a little absurd, I thought. And it was easier to laugh. And the beginning was really tough, I thought, to laugh, because yeah. It was sort of a shock value.
Yeah, there are, I don't know what you call these exactly, but the allusions of some kind or another to many of his previous films. And I think you're right. I mean, at least I think that's one of the things he's doing, is he's poking fun at his whole corpus of work, or commenting on it, or critiquing it, or making some sort of commentary about all of his previous films. I went and looked at a few others when I had, you know, back at the beginning of the year when I had first seen this. Like in The Unforgiven, there's a character in there that likes to go around doing this.
Yeah.
You know, a ridiculous gunslinger who finally gets his comeuppance. And there's a guy in The Unforgiven, this braggart, this young guy who claims to have killed all these people, turns out to be a scared kid who's never killed anybody, and he's kind of a Tao at the end, and Clint Eastwood has to save him. So there's, and those of you who have seen all the Clint Eastwood movies probably saw a whole lot of stuff like that. That you know, all, so they're all being brought in for us to remember, and they all end differently than this one.
I have two comments. At the beginning, in terms of the bigotry and being able to laugh, there were certain things that we could identify with, the belly ring and the inappropriate clothing for the funeral, the lack of respect from the sons. There were certain things that made you identify with him early on, and I think that put a crack in the door, or even if we were unable to laugh at those words at the beginning, you did sort of, you were sort of on his side in some ways. And the other thing that I wanted to mention is that I kept thinking of this movie in the context of what you said in my tenuous grasp of what theology of the cross is going to hell, going straight to hell with them in a for Tao. He went into hell for Tao, and that's that when he appeared on that lawn at the gang's house.
Mm-hmm. What were you going to say, Jack?
I wanted to say that I'm curious about how weakness gets portrayed in a very strong protagonist in Clint Eastwood, as he is fairly, well, he's weakened all throughout the movie, beginning with his wife's death. And to me, you want to talk about the theology of the cross, or that God is made known in weakness, that as he progressively gets weaker, the question I'd ask is, how did he come to that final act of self-giving? How did he get there from where he was most of his life, a strong American? And so that's what I look at, the theme of weakness as it gets unraveled, as he gets weaker, more vulnerable.
Well, personally, I thought what was going on, he's becoming physically weaker, yeah, and sick and all that, but it appeared to me, I don't know Clint Eastwood's religion. I don't know whether he's a practicing Christian or if he's a practicing anything or what, but going back to the idea that it begins and ends with confession, the big confession he finally makes to Tao is that he shot a kid who didn't want to do anything but give up. And he says just a bit earlier, just before that moment, he explains when the priest tells him that he should take it easy on himself because he only did what he was ordered to do, and he says, it's not the stuff you're ordered to do that haunts you for the rest of your life, it's the stuff you weren't ordered to do. And so I think that what was going on in him was what we call repentance. He was coming to terms with the truth of his life and all the people he had killed. And it wasn't just that he had had to kill some people because he was in war, but he had killed people he didn't have to kill. He had done stuff that wasn't his duty. So there, in one sense, you could think maybe he's doing penance for this, you know. But at the very least, what he was doing was saving a kid who was about to end up doing the same thing that happened to the kid that he killed. I don't know who was first here.
When she said, the girls go to college, but the boys go to jail, I thought there was just a little silent moment there that started the crack of his thinking about these young boys.
Yeah.
Comparing them to the boys that he killed.
Well, there's no question but that he loved Tao, and he wanted Tao to be different than these other kids. What were you going to say?
So I like the growth of the priest through it, but the line that struck me was when the priest said, well, it seems like you know more about death than you know about living. You know more about dying than you know about living. And it was almost like from that point, he lived. He chose, he was, even though he was making this sacrifice, he was finally living.
Which almost fits the theology of the cross's parade verse about cross-bearing, you know, that you find your life by losing it. This paradox, and you you almost see it happening. Once he's ready to do what he's going to do, he starts really living right back.
Partly in response to your question about how does he get there, I think the role of community, this comes in here too, in terms of there's a turning point, like the family, the Hmong families that lives next door, they're in some senses, despite the gang experience, they're still in some sense an intact community, and it's Suk, is that her name, who gets through his defenses and it's his birthday, and he's out of beer, and she invites him over for food, and he's only got beef jerky, and we have beer too, so hospitality, and this abundance when he goes next door and he finds this, you know, this overflowing food, and that also starts appearing on his doorstep. But I think that there's something very compelling, and he finds community. He says something about, I find, you know, these are people closer to me than my own family.
Yeah, yeah, he makes that speech into the mirror.
I have more in common with these people.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's an epithet. He says, I got more in common with a bunch of gooks than with my own family.
And it goes both ways, because Tao couldn't have found his way into white working society and the tough man's world that, you know, of the construction without his education by Clint Eastwood, you know, and that's what the gang kids didn't have. They didn't have a mentor that would help them, you know, find their way in society. And that I thought was the indictment there, right? That the rest of the kids were jealous of him, and that's why they put the cigarette butt out in his face. And it was an indictment of that, why can't these folks find a role, a place? And that's part of the game, piece to that movie.
Over here.
I was just going to say that I think it's that feeling of attachment and closeness to his community when, you know, he witnesses the suffering of, you know, both Tao and Sue. I think that's what kind of puts him over the top to finally realize, you know, what he needs to do. So it's when you see people close to you suffer, that sometimes that makes you, can make some people stronger within to do the right thing or to step up a notch. And I think that, combined with what you had said earlier, you know, leads to his final actions. Just wanted to add that.
I just wondered why he did the confession he did to the priest. And didn't really address any of the things the priest was expecting from him, I thought. And then he eventually does more of the confession to Tao. And I just wondered about what people...
Yeah, what do you think is the meaning? Anybody got a thought on the meaning of the confession that he does make to the priest finally? I mean, one of them is a big deal. I never knew how to be a father. I couldn't relate to my own sons, but... not paying $900, not paying
to
the taxes on
wife.
Nine.
Yeah.
To honor his wife.
I agree.
What?
To honor his wife.
Mm-hmm. Well, except that, you know, the priest tells him to go out. He says, so, you know, the priest says, isn't there anything else? And he says, well, I really felt bad about what I did to my sons. You know, he basically says, this has been bothering me for a long, long time. And then the priest says, well, go do this and that, and five Hail Marys. But that's not what he did, is it? I mean, what he did in response was develop sort of a relationship with the folks next door that he'd never had with his sons, you know, and he sort of overcame that and was able to do that. So I thought there was this humorous aspect to the priest's response And then his response, I don't know if he ever did the Hail Marys, but he certainly took actions to repair the damage he had done to himself by denying his relationship to his son and their family.
There's a powerful symbolism, too, when the priest says something to him after the confession. I think it's by a baptismal font, even. And he says, "I've got peace." And the priest says, "Jesus Christ."
Yeah. That's the last thing that the priest says to him
yeah.
before he leaves. Is, and it's, you don't know whether it's an epithet or what, but he says, "Jesus."
Well, the
Christ.
End, when he's lying on the ground.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's not an accident.
I think the whole scene is an interesting commentary on how I think that probably none of us can really deny it, how we often expect forgiveness and things by going through the motions of the church as an institution, while actually forgiveness and confession is realized in the way that you live your life, not necessarily by just doing something like that, but how you incorporate that into your everyday experience.
It is interesting, though, what he chooses to confess to the priest. It's about a betrayal of his wife. It's about not being the sort of parent he should have been. And it's about something related to his work. Right, it's because, what is, or some, it's about that.
The sort of vocal order, and you didn't
yeah.
pay the capital gains.
And so,
tax,
in some ways, it maybe says something about what he's starting to feel is most important, too. That would be, as we're talking about this, I'm wondering about that.
Yeah.
And the priest tells him earlier that it seems you know more about death than living. And he doesn't confess about, you know, the things he did about death, like those are the things he did in life while living.
You know, that's a, there's that thing about your greatest witness is what you do to those closest to you. You know, you hear that sometimes. And in some ways, you know, that's what he talked about when he did his confession to the priest.
I don't think... Well, I think that he realized that the priest wouldn't realize his confession about war anyhow. Because anybody that's been in combat, you've had the ultimate in competition, you know, competing for your life when you're 18 or 19 years old. And you know, he talked about his 40-year career, but he was still living with that other feeling of that greatest event in his life. And it's hard to understand that. But that sticks with you a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was really clear at the end, that everything that his wife had said, that the shaman said, that everybody said, there was a terrible burden in his, on his soul, that needed resolution of some kind.
And I think all of the guys that have been in combat, you know, the ones coming back now, they're having a tough time because they've already done the ultimate. Now, what do you put on for a bookend? So his bookend was, you know, getting these guys in jail. He had these two ends of his life, and the middle part of it was, you know, two sentences about working in an automobile factory.
Yeah. We have just a few minutes. What do you think about why this film in this moment in our culture? Is it just an accident? Total coincidence, or?
I thought it was a statement about Clint Eastwood's age, that he probably had a message to get out, that he wanted to get out, and time maybe might be of essence. I was surprised how he had aged. I hadn't seen him for a while. That was my feeling.
Of course, I think he wrote it for veterans, you know, to help them rehab.
And I see it's a film of its time because of all the, we do have a huge melting right now that we don't really talk about in terms of a wave going through our culture. We have a huge melting of people from Asian cultures and from Hispanic cultures moving in, and there's a lot of bigotry going on, and we don't, I mean, I think it really juxtaposed, and we understood that in a comedic sense and a human sense about this movie at this time, where 10 years ago I'm not sure we would have understood it in the same way.
I'd also comment on the fact that Detroit is almost like the character. It's an aging corporation, and it may end up dying. I don't know about Ford, but you know, we've listened to how GM is troubled. And I would just simply say that in our time, this moment we're in, what it means to be American is being rethought. We thought power worked. I mean, I think we went through a decade of where American power seemed to, an empire seemed to be our identity. And that's very, I think Americans are very disillusioned by that. That has not worked for meaning. And it's this sense of self-giving, not getting, but self-giving, that seems to me to be relevant to the powerful people who have in our country.
It's interesting, we're a very vengeful and revengeful nation, and all of his movies in the past have fostered that idea. The interesting, I agree with you that now is that, you know, we're beginning to reevaluate that. It'd be interesting to talk to him and find out what he now sees as maybe a way to repair some of the damage that he personally has added to the pot.
Well, I think I love Clint Eastwood. I love every single one of his movies. I hate his movies, but I'm engaged by them at times, and I like that about him. And I think there's history in the last 2 years. I felt like there was this old guy who, the bigotry didn't bother me in this movie when I saw it either time, because I didn't believe it was him. I just didn't believe that that's deep down, that was what was in this guy. I thought it was what it ended up being in the end of the movie. And I think he's kind of saying, I mean, he's had this career where he's totally changed the way he's making movies now, and they're completely different than what they were at the beginning. He's almost saying, both in the movie and by the movies he's making, I'm not who I was in the beginning. I'm more profound than this. I have more points to make than this. It's not just about the cop movie with the big gun. I have something to share, and he's done it in so, like, the last five or six movies. He's made these profound, like, very dramatic points, and it's really neat to watch.
I think another subtle sub-theme in here has to do with young people today and the threat of gangs.
Yes.
And this is not just an American phenomenon, but an international phenomenon.
I would agree.
And, I mean, even in Afghanistan and Pakistan, where the whole thrust of educating the women to keep the culture alive, because the young men are going off to the jihad, you know, and the importance of mentoring and trying to reach kids and deal with this gang culture. There's just a lot that's said, I think, in the movie about that.
Yeah, it seemed to me that he saved Tao at kind of a couple of levels, because, you know, there was the big dramatic at the end saving,
But he helped him get into the American culture of work and buying your own tools rather than an alternative to the long young person way of entering into society. And that there was a point where after the rape, the priest was at his house and said they didn't, the moms don't talk. They didn't talk about what had happened, and so there was no way to pursue the guys. But after his sacrifice, that whole community, that whole neighborhood, talked to the police. And so they weren't strictly the Hmong culture that doesn't talk to authorities anymore. That somehow they had shifted or transformed a little bit, that they talked, which is what allowed these guys to get arrested. And so that seemed to me, the Americanization of this pocket of Hmong folk in a way that wasn't stripping them of their original heritage, but making it easier for them to participate in the one they now found themselves in.
I think there was just
an interesting point too, how sometimes, you know, within your own immediate family, when you've got your family troubles and family issues, it's nice to realize that, you know, maybe that your neighbors next door are people that you can develop friendships with and turn to and have a sense of community. Because we all know within our own families, you know, we've got the relatives that are just, you know, crazy and stuff. And so I think that was a small little point too. And so get to know your neighbors, you know, regardless of their ethnicity and diversity. And sometimes those relationships are more meaningful than self within your own immediate family. So keep that in mind.
Just to add to that, the interplay between vulnerability and community, both on the part of the moms and the part of the boss, is allowing himself to be vulnerable, to say, I need help, or to say yes to hospitality, and how that plays a role in the movie. I found very interesting.
Yeah. I don't know quite where this fits in, but when I think about the whole movie, it seems like the transformations that occurred in the different characters were responses to acts of love from the beginning. Whether not in a sentimental sense, but in the sense of people being willing to see past the surface and actually, you know, naming a person or naming something or seeing something as it is rather than. You know, in terms of what's being projected. And I think that Clint Eastwood's character in particular was transformed because people are willing to, you know, whether it's because of his weakness, you know, suddenly here's this tough guy who has weaknesses that can be, you know, so that he has needs all of a sudden. But that in itself too just shows the strong need that people have to care for each other and to give that love, which then is spread out in other ways. Not necessarily returning to the person who has given it in the first place. I don't know.
Yeah.
I also liked the little interplay between him and the grandma on the porch.
Yes.
I just thought there was never any conversation between the two of them that either one of them could understand, but I certainly thought that was, because boy, she was as tough as he was. I think she probably had the same prejudices that she did, but I just loved the interplay between those two.
And the fact that he gives his most precious son to her.
To her, right? The dog at the end.
I loved it. Who wants the last word?
Take it.
Yeah, you take it.
You get it.
Well, I don't really have that much more to say. I mean, I guess the one line nobody's brought up yet is that Walt says right at the end, just before the big climax, I've got a light.
Yeah, a light. That's right. I remember that.
He's got a clue.
But in fact, I heard it as I've got light.
Yeah. I've got light. Well, thank you. Yeah.